7BR Part Heard. Hello, and welcome to 7BR's Part Heard, the podcast that traverses the legal landscape, examining issues across multiple practice areas, guided by the diverse expertise of our members. I'm Rhys Palmer, Chambers Paralegal. We're joined today by 7BR members Hugh Preston QC and Jonathan Bertram. We're here today to discuss the future for representative actions in the light of Supreme Court case Lloyd against George, and in particular, how consumer law and data protection claims might be brought in the future. Hugh is a leading silk in the fields of consumer law, product liability, clinical negligence, and personal injury, and has particular expertise in all areas of group litigation. He is ranked as a leading silk by Legal 500 and a star individual by Chambers and Partners, where he has also been included in the new spotlight ranking for group litigation. Hugh has been involved in some of the highest profile consumer law group actions in recent years, including the PIP breast implant litigation, Pinnacle hip litigation, claims arising from cancer caused by textured breast implants, and Volkswagen emissions litigation. His particular expertise in consumer law statutory remedies. Jonathan specialises in clinical negligence and product liability and has been ranked as a leading clinical negligence and product liability junior by both Chambers and Partners and the Legal 500. He has been instructed in several major group actions for claimants in the product liability field, including the Pinnacle hip implant group litigation. Aside from clinical negligence and product liability, Jonathan undertakes other consumer law work and undertakes general professional negligence, including claims arising from failed litigation, as well as claims concerning the conduct of those working in the financial industry. Hugh, Jonathan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Rhys.
Thank you.
So when we do these podcasts, firstly, thank you for joining me. It's a pleasure to have some new guests on the podcast. I always like to take things back to the beginning, and we start with just a general outline of where we're going. So, Hugh, if I start with you, what exactly is a representative action?
Good place to start, Rhys. It's a small and rather underutilized section of the CPR in CPR 19.6 or 19.8, to be precise. And it's a section that those of us doing group litigation have tended to rather race through rather quickly as we turn the pages to the section dealing with GLOs, group litigation orders, which Jonathan and I have done a lot of. And representative actions we always thought were rather arcane and dealing with sort of shareholder disputes and chancery division matters and that, things like that. More recently, people have started to use them in a wider field. Essentially, it's where you have, rather than a traditional group action where you've got lots of clients all grouping together, all representing a solicitor's firm and then some test cases going to trial. Instead, you only have one client, one claimant, one single representative. They bring the action, and the solicitor only ever represents that one individual, potentially. And you then get a judgment on behalf that representative represents the entire class of people who may be affected by that particular claim or cause of action. It only works where you have all the people in the class, maybe millions of people in the class, all with an identical claim, identical issue to run before the court. Where it's truly identical, the court will allow one single nominal representative to bring that claim and effectively claim, potentially claim damages on behalf of the entire class. And we've tended not to do that in group litigation because the sort of product liability work that Jonathan and I have been dealing with in the past tends to be personal injury, and therefore everybody's injury is different, everybody's damages are different. So we tend to move on to the GLO section.
One of the cases that we're here to talk today about is Lloyd and Google. Jonathan, could you just give us a background to that and just run us through what happened in that case?
Sure. So in terms of the background to Lloyd and Google, Mr. Lloyd acted as a representative of all iPhone users who had used an iPhone between August 2011 and February 2012. And he was bringing a claim against Google because Google had been able to place a particular type of cookie on these iPhone devices without the user's permission. And that cookie would, if you like, respond when those users access certain websites on the internet when using it each day. And as a result, Google began to, through the utilization of this cookie, began to harvest huge amounts of data about how you and I, if we had an iPhone at that time point, using it, buying a train ticket, doing our shopping, looking at the football results. And they started to accumulate vast amounts of information, which they were able to break down, if you like, as a result of the information they're gaining, and identify groups of interests and groups of users who had a common interest between them. So examples might be people who are particularly interested in football. And the result of accumulating so much information, they were able to sell particular sort of advertising slots and advertisement opportunities to those who wanted to advertise on websites. So in effect, what you're getting is highly targeted advertising, chasing down to people who are most likely to purchase the product or the services that are being advertised. And the issue here was fundamentally, the iPhone users hadn't consented to the use of their data in this way. Google were taking advantage of it and were making almost certainly vast amounts of money out of it. So what essentially happens is Mr. Lloyd starts an action on behalf of all of these iPhone users for breach of the Data Protection Act. And because Google are based in the US, he needed the permission of the court to serve proceedings out of this jurisdiction. And that was the beginnings of the litigation. That process initially started in an unusual way with an application in the High Court. That application was dismissed. So Mr. Lloyd lost round one. He appeals to the Court of Appeal. He persuades them of the merits of his case. Court of Appeal reverses the first instance decision. He's allowed to serve out. He's got prospects of success. He can move his litigation forwards. He's appealed up to the Supreme Court, which is a decision we're focusing on today. And there, the justices unanimously overturned the Court of Appeal's decision and restored the decision of first instance and concluded that it was not appropriate to grant Mr. Lloyd permission to serve his case outside of the UK, and that, in fact, the prospects of his claim succeeding were poor, and he couldn't proceed further. Now, what's interesting about this case is what the Supreme Court actually decided about why he couldn't pursue this litigation. Because the way he was seeking to bring this case, and touched upon by Hugh just a moment or two ago, is unlike in personal injury cases where, by definition, you are injured differently. I might break my leg if I fall over. You might just twist your ankle if you fall over. Your damages are going to be different. Here, what he was seeking to do was claim a common sum in damage on behalf of each of the iPhone users. He was claiming notionally £750 on behalf of each user, and there were a maximum of about 4 million users of iPhones during this particular period of time. So this represented a potential liability to Google in the order of £3 billion. It was a massive potential liability for them. Now, what the Supreme Court decided in Lloyd, having carried out a fascinating review, and I suppose we'll touch on this a little bit in a little while, a fascinating review of history of representative actions and the requirements for them and the elements to them. It came to sort of zero and laser down and focus on the precise way in which the action was being brought, because the action is being brought under the Data Protection Act, and specifically a section of that act, in the 1998 Act, Section 13. And what was at its heart, what was being said was, it was not necessary, Mr. Lloyd says, it was not necessary for him to show or to prove individual damage or individual distress in any particular case. It was sufficient, under his interpretation of Section 13, that there had been some loss of control of iPhone users' data, and that was sufficient in and of itself to enable him to claim damages on their behalf. He was seeking to claim them on a lump sum basis. And he was interpreting Section 13 of the Data Protection Act in that particular way. And after thoroughly reviewing the law and analysing the respective arguments, the Supreme Court came down on the view that, that's simply not the way in which Section 13 of the Data Protection Act can be interpreted. To succeed in a claim, it is necessary to prove either damage or distress. And as soon as you engaged with that analysis, the representative action was in all sorts of difficulties, because that would mean that every and each claimant would need to prove what their particular circumstances were, their particular damage that flowed or the particular distress that flowed. And it wasn't appropriate to claim a generalized lump sum for this idea of losing control of your data, which is how he was seeking to put his case. And once he lost that point, everything else fell away.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, as Jonathan has been saying, and there's much in that decision which is, in a sense, good news for defendants. That's the general reaction in the marketplace.
Yes.
But I do actually think that there's some really interesting stuff in the decision which is good for claimants and potentially may in time be seen to be good for claimants, although that's not the way in which it's being talked about. Lord Leggett, in principle, was spoke in quite favourable terms about the availability of this route wherever there is a true common issue. And even in a case where you've got, say, a common issue on liability, but different damages, he spoke about this idea of picking up on some of the academic tests about a bifurcated procedure where you could have a decision on liability, perhaps combined with a declaration that anybody who had, so in this case, Lloyd and Google, saying, look, the claimant could have said, let's have a decision on liability that there's been a data breach, plus a declaration. The declaration would say something like, anybody who has been injured has suffered loss as a result of this breach would be entitled to bring a claim. Then, of course, people then go and bring individual claims. That wouldn't really have been of so much direct interest to funders because they're not getting cash up front at the end of the decision. But actually, it's quite interesting. And in terms of other areas of law where traditionally we might use a GLO structure, and we spent a lot of time in the Pinnacle litigation debating and discussing, and I mean, this is open, there's no secret in this, discussing how we might invite the court to have a preliminary issue trial on whether that product was defective. Mm. And that was in essentially where the claimants were coming from, defendants saying, no, in a GLO, you've got to have lead cases, you've got to involve causation, you've got to involve loss, you've got to put it all in front of the table. But actually looking at Lord Leggett's decision here, saying, well, you know, overriding objective, need to manage cases appropriately, level playing field, et cetera, those are all factors he thought that militate in favour of having a representative action to decide a true common issue.
And so I think in summary, one can say, it was a bad day for claimants on the facts of this particular case. But actually, if you look under the bonnet of the decision, you can see the building blocks of what could be a consumer law class action, perhaps in the future on different facts in a different situation.
I agree with that, Hugh. I think particularly the bifurcation model, if you like, sounds like a very interesting way of trying to manage large-scale litigation going forward. It's just fundamentally whether there's going to be a funders market for those kinds of pieces of litigation. But it strikes me that there ought to be, in the sense that the initial process of your representative claim could actually be pretty cost-effective to the funder. I mean, if you compare and contrast the costs of pursuing a GLO on everything's in issue. You take a Pinnacle, if you look at the cost of doing a large piece of litigation like that with all the risks that entails in terms of the financial risk, it might be thought that a bifurcated representative action is quite attractive because you may be able to get to your declaratory relief in a relatively cost-effective way. And at that point, you've won. And so in terms of turning to the market and getting the clients through the door and onboarded, you would have thought that would be an easier process because you're not going to be saying to potential clients, well, if you go through all this process, you might possibly get some damages at the end of it. You're going to be able to say, well, look, here's a decision. If you can tick all the right boxes, then you're going to get something. It may not be very much, but you're going to get something. And it strikes me that that is likely to be an easier sell in the market generally to consumers than the current GLO model. And I guess what you'd have after a bifurcated hearing, I suppose, is you'd have your judgment giving you declaratory relief, and then presumably some form of opt-in GLO to follow on and move that forward. And I would have thought that funders will want to investigate that.
So now moving forwards, what does this now mean for consumer law cases? Will they be able to be brought as representative actions? And if so, how do you do that?
Well, we've obviously spoken a little bit already. Jonathan's mentioned how potentially cases that otherwise would be a GLO case could be run on, say, liability and things like that as a representative action. But if you want to look at cases where you could actually run the entire claim, including the financial remedy, as a representative action in the way that they're trying to do in Lloyd and Google, as I say, the general mood music out there is those days are over. I don't think that's right. I think with a bit of lateral thinking,
and looking at these cases in a slightly different way, if one can conceive of a course of action where not only the liability issue is the same, but the remedy is also identical, then the Supreme Court is saying, no problem. In fact, you're positively encouraged to bring it in this way as a way of improving access to justice and level playing field, etc. And those are the cases, it seems to me, that what would be where you are claiming a statutory remedy. And I can think of three in particular. One is a remedy under the CPUT regulations, unfair practice regulations to protect consumers, where you've got misleading actions by defendants. Those are the causes of action that are included, for example, in the current Volkswagen Dieselgate litigation, where you are entitled to a tariff-based percentage reduction of a price paid, where the partial refund that you get is driven principally by reference to the defendant's conduct rather than by reference to the individual claimant's circumstances and losses. So that would be a common, potentially a common remedy for everybody. That's one example. And two more, I think, you find in the Consumer Rights Act. So this would be breach of contract cases where you have substandard goods, you're entitled to a full or partial refund. And again, the refund is based upon the defect in the goods rather than in the claimant's individual losses. So those are straightforward product liability claims where you don't have a consequential injury, but you do have a glitch in a product where you're entitled to a partial refund. No reason at all why that can't be run as a class action. And the third, also in the Consumer Rights Act, very underutilized part of the Consumer Rights Act, is where you have a contract for services and there are substandard services. You are also subject to a couple of hoops one has to jump over. We won't go into that now, but in principle entitled to a partial refund, even if you've suffered no loss. So those sorts of causes of action where you're not looking at the claimant's losses, but you're looking at a statutory remedy, relatively new in English law, come in from Europe over the last couple of decades, statutory remedy based upon the defendant's conduct. I think those are the areas where you could have potentially a future representative action in consumer law.
And then what about data protection claims? Is there any way that these can be brought as representative actions?
I think just picking up from the point I've just made about substandard services, a claim under the data protection legislation is going to be difficult if you want to claim the financial remedy as part of the representative action for the reasons that, they've said in Supreme Court said in Lloyd and Google. But if you just take a step back, may not be on the facts on Google, but it wouldn't be difficult to conceive of data protection claims based on data leaks where there is a contractual relationship between the parties. For example, a subscription service for a sort of Dropbox, Trezorit, cloud-based data storage type company where you pay a subscription if there's a data leak. If everybody is paying the same price for the service, then why is the failure to keep your data safe, why is that not also, maybe a breach of data protection legislation, but why is it not also a breach of contract, a failure to take reasonable care and skill? If so, then a claimant is entitled to a statutory remedy of a partial refund. And that, of course, is precisely the kind of common remedy available to all that they didn't have in Lloyd and Google. Why? Because they were making the claim under the data protection legislation. In another case on different facts, where you've got a contractual relationship and the claim is brought under the Consumer Rights Act. And it seems to me that you could do so. So my sort of thought on this, looking on the upside in future, is that if we look at Consumer Rights Act, consumer contract areas, I appreciate those are particular areas of my practice and Jonathan's too, so there are areas of particular interest. But if we can look at causes of action under those vehicles, then you get to a statutory remedy, which is truly common potentially to all claimants. You're back in the game with a class action. And that's just looking at cases in a different way, I think, rather than being too rigid in looking at them in terms of data protection legislation. Jonathan, what do you think? Is that viable, do you think?
I think that is a viable way of trying to, if you like, crack the nut of data claims without having to go back to the DPAs. I mean, it's pretty clear, isn't it, in the light of the ruling in Lloyd, that a 1998 Data Protection Act claim predicated on Section 13, loss of control of data, is dead in the water. That clearly is going to be going nowhere as a representative action or as an individual claim, in fact. There are some interesting questions around whether actions brought under essentially the GDPR regime through the Data Protection Act 2018 would have a better prospect of success. It's worth noting, perhaps unsurprisingly, that Lloyd and Google is very much focused on Section 13 of the DPA 1998, and specifically under that regime, and then they're at pains to make that clear. And there is perhaps some scope for arguing about loss of control in and of itself being sufficient, irrespective of proving damage, to bring a case under that regime. Because when you look at Article 82 of the GDPR, it makes clear that a claim for compensation is available for any person who suffered material or non-material damage as a result of an infringement of the GDPR regulations. And when you look at Section 168 of the 2018 DPA, it defines non-material damage to include distress, but doesn't exhaustively define it as distress. And when you read that in conjunction with one of the recitals to the GDPR, which gives us an example, when it's just giving examples of personal data breaches, a data breach, if not addressed in an appropriate and timely manner, may result in physical, material, or non-material damage to natural persons, such as loss of control over the personal data. It seems to me that it opens up, there is a bit more width there as to whether a claim based purely on loss of control and put as non-material damage might have some prospect of success under as a representative action under the DPA 2018 and the GDPR regime. But it's relatively untested, though I can see from some of the other commentaries I've been reading about this that there is currently some litigation going on, I think in Austria, looking at whether loss of control per se is sufficient to found a basis under the GDPR. Now, obviously, that would be a decision, a European decision that isn't going to be binding on England and Wales or UK going forwards. But it's likely to be persuasive, I would have thought, in this area, and it may shine some further light on that. But as a general point, I think it's going to be very challenging to bring mass class action data protection claims unless you're being more creative in the way that we were just discussing with the Consumer Rights Act.
Well, Hugh, Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you very much, Ruth. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you to our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and Hugh and Jonathan's thoughts on the future of representative actions. If you enjoyed this week's episode of Part Heard, you can find more like this on Chambers' website or across other major streaming platforms. Until next week. Thank you and goodbye.